Today on The Grave Talks, part two of our conversation with psychic sisters Jennifer James and Jill Stanley about their new book, Ghosts on the Road, Murder and Mysterious Deaths. And the book's written in a very interesting way. It's like the podcast, like you're reading a transcript. And so I like the way it's written. It's conversational, and you can really pick up on your personalities, too, as you're reading the book.
Thank you. The book was a surprise for Jennifer and I. We wanted to write a book. We didn't know what that would look like. There was a publisher, Martin Sisters Publishing, Melissa Newman, had listened to an episode of our podcast and reached out to us via email asking us if we would be interested in writing a book. And Jen and I had a conversation, and there was just no way we couldn't add anything new to what we were already doing because we are just really, really busy. Although we did put out into the universe that we would love someone to believe in us to finance a project that we could work on with our good friend, Jenny Baker.
Well, I do want to add here, we were also very clear when we were trying to manifest this project that it couldn't be something new. We don't have time. Jill works a full-time job. I work a full-time job. We don't have time for another thing. So if this project could be born of something already in existence that we could just use, that would work.
Right.
That makes sense.
We couldn't afford anything else out of pocket either. So right. Someone was going to have to finance it for us because there's no way. So when we got the email, Jen and I had a conversation and we thought we were going to say to Melissa during our Zoom meeting, we're flattered. We appreciate, you know, your interest in what we're doing, but we just don't have the time.
Then she said, well, I was thinking of, you know, publishing a book of your stories. And we were like, you mean the stories that we've already done, already researched, already talked about? And she's like, yeah. And then we're like, okay. And then she says, and it would be, I'm not a vanity publisher, you know, I would cover all the costs. And we're like, okay. And then she says, and if you know an editor, we could work, you know, bring on an editor that you know. And of course, our friend Jenny Baker, who we wanted to work on a project, was talking about being an editor. So it all just kind of fit together. And I guess we accidentally manifested it when we were, you know, together. That happens a lot, by the way, Carol, like when Jill and I get together with wine and sit and talk about things, they do happen. And I'm not sure why or how, but I think you really need to be careful of the energy that you're putting out and the information that you're giving to the universe, because the universe is listening.
Yeah.
Or in your case, maybe grandma.
Yes. Yes.
Sisters shouldn't let sisters drunk manifest, because like my neighbor's not waving to me anymore. So I have to fix that.
You have to explain that. That doesn't make any sense.
I live in a place where I live on a lake where people have to pass my house if they're getting to different areas of their property several times in a short period of time. And when you live in the country in Michigan, folks around here like to wave. Well, if you're going past my house like five times in 15 minutes, we don't have to wave every time, do we? Right. So I had that conversation with one of my neighbors. I'm like, you know what, buddy, I love you. It's awkward now. Like, you know, we don't have to keep doing this. And then like no one was waving for me for like a week. And I was like, okay. So I had to go back to the kid and I was like, I do like waves. Please continue to wave to me. Because then all of a sudden, like everyone was like, got the memo in spirit to stop waving to me.
I had to do that with a guy I work with once. And I'm like, okay, you know, it's been years. I don't have to high five you every time I walk by you in the hallway. Because every time we'd walk by, he'd be like, put it up here, Carol. And I'm like, I'm going to the bathroom. You know, I don't have to high five you today.
The book, it's based on the transcripts. It is. It's based on the stories, but it's really not the transcripts. We took those as the starting point, and we really tightened up the stories, because when you're having a conversation about something, you know, there are a lot of tangents, there are a lot of, you know, inside jokes. And so we really tightened all of that up so that even if you don't know us, and even if you don't listen to the podcast, you can still pick up this book and you can get a story and enjoy a story.
And there are some really, really good stories in here. So what I thought we could do is talk about one story and kind of how you approached it, how you were led to that story, how you researched the story once, because, and you want these to be verifiable stories. So you might be led someplace, but you can't verify anything. So these are all stories that you verified. So I was like, I want to pick out, and I knew going into it, I want to look at a certain story. But the interesting thing is I live in Kansas, and on our other show, Real Ghost Stories Online, a woman has written in a couple stories from LeBeck County, Kansas. And LeBeck County, Kansas happens to be home at one time of the Bloody Bender family. So I took my sister and I, which is really interesting because you two are sisters, and we did those episodes together. I'm fascinated by these Bloody Benders. So I see this story, the butchers, the witches, the dead in the ditches in LeBeck County, Kansas. And I'm like, oh, what the heck could it be? Wait, oh my God, that has to be about the Bloody Benders. So that's why I picked this one. And also, you started out in my town in Wichita, Kansas. You were here. And so I kind of wanted to start with you were here and drawn to serial killers. The idea of serial killer.
Yeah, that's true.
So on this particular road trip, we knew we had to be at our brother's house, who lives in a different area of Kansas. But we had been on the road for about maybe 5 days at this point, and we were just using our psychic abilities to be guided to areas to get different stories. When we were in Arkansas, I think we were in Arkansas and then Kansas. When we were approaching the Kansas state line, it became very clear to me that there was evil in Kansas. And that was what came across. And then Jennifer and I had a conversation of what kind of evil, where is that coming from? And it occurred to me that it felt like there was a serial killer vibe. Then we had lunch at Pizza Hut in in Wichita.
Which is where it was originated, here in Wichita.
And it was so good, not disappointed at all. And we, at that point when we were in the car, I started looking up on my phone, serial killers. And of course, an infamous one, I don't even want to say his name, is from Wichita. And it just felt so vile that couldn't be our story.
And Jennifer is vile. It is evil.
Right. I don't like, literally, it's like, oh. And Jen was disgusted immediately. And she was like, that's not our story. I'm like, okay, but that energy of that vileness has to do with something that we need to talk about. And so we were like, okay, deal, but that's not who we're going to give a voice to. Like, that's not going to happen. And it felt right to say hard pass on that. But Jennifer wanted to go on the Osage Trail east. She was drawn east from Wichita, but we had to be at our brother's. So I was like, okay, I feel you on that, but we have to end up at Chris's house, which is in the opposite direction. So we sat down and we were writing down our hits of what we were picking up associated with the Osage Trail east. And I'm not looking at the hits, Jen, are you?
I'm not, but I think the most important ones were serial killers on the Osage Trail. And as it turns out, the research, it was glaring that the Bender family was in the 1870s established a settlement on the Osage Trail, which was a major thoroughfare at the time for people heading west, and are known as the country's first serial killers.
Which to me, it was fascinating that you would have picked up on that, because it's really a story that a lot of people don't really know about.
Right. And to be honest, our intention is always to look for or to have the spirits guide us to a verifiable story previously unknown to us that gives voice to the voiceless. And when the Wichita serial killer came up, I already knew about him. Like, there was a B movie about him. So again, we felt very clear that was not our story. And when Jen was being pulled to the Osage Trail, we had done a we were just in Oklahoma and we were picking up some other energy. So to have that energy carry through and Jen being pulled back east and thinking Osage Trail was really interesting. And it really connected where we needed to be looking at the research.
And I also think too, we're not just telling a story to tell a story. We always bring a new perspective to it. And in fact, when we realized that the Bender family was well known in the area, it was kind of a turnoff for us because, okay, so this has already been written about. You can Google this and there's a lot of information out there. So we always ask, why us? What new do you want us to, you know, what new information spirits do you want us to bring? Right. And so for the Benders, I think we were both surprised with the information that came through to us.
Quick question. Do you find when you're drawn to a story that maybe it's one person's side of the story, like one person was really wronged, but it wasn't really made obvious at the time or something, you know, that one person maybe is the one that wants you to tell the story?
I have an example of what you're thinking of, but I do want to say with the Bender family, before we switch topics, is that we found psychically that these people were not related and possibly part of a larger crime syndicate.
Oh, so you're saying, the Bender family themselves are not a family.
Right.
You don't think so.
You don't think so at all.
Because it is sketchy. I've read it's mom, dad, brother, sister, mom, dad, son, wife.
Mm-hmm.
And why does no one know? And they bizarrely disappeared. And where did they go?
Exactly.
And they couldn't, the goods and money that they were getting from slaughtering travelers on the Osage Trail, unless they had a way to kind of traffic it into like real, like legit means and money and currency, then people would be suspicious of why the Benders in that Labette, Kansas have that much money, right?
Right.
So there had to be a way to kind of for them to utilize that those gains in a way that wouldn't draw attention. And there's no way that they could have done that without being a part of someone helping them and getting in some way trafficking and laundering that money into currency that wasn't suspicious.
And we should like give a little bit more information for people because these people would travel and they basically had like an inn where people would stay with them and then they'd murder them.
Right. What would happen is, like Jen said, the Osage Trail was a very popular thoroughfare throughout the regions. Like if you were going east from Wichita, you were probably on the Osage Trail. And all like out of nowhere, this family of four, and I'm using air quotes, develop an inn, which is really like a small room with a small, like one bedroom extra room. And they would provide dinner and a place to stay for people who are traveling the trail. While they checked in and they were having dinner, Papa Bender and their kind of bizarre quote unquote son would stand behind like a canvas and attack the traveler. While they were either distracted by their daughter, Kate, who was said to be had mystical abilities herself and was very beautiful and distracting and kind of flirtatious from what I gather. And when they were eating, the boys in the family would slaughter whomever was sitting at the table at the time. So then they would bury them on their property somewhere under their house, underneath a shed or in the field, and then they would take their belongings, their money, their belongings, and somehow, like I said, launder them into regular currency in some way. Like even they would have to get rid of their horses. Do you see what I'm saying? Like those are the kind of things that you would have to think of. Like if you just killed someone, his horse is outside. Now what do we do? That's why it seems like
wagon.
Other people involved in this to help them get rid of that kind of. Because a horse is valuable, you're not going to kill it. You're going to sell it to someone.
Exactly.
So someone had to know that like they were coming up with means in a way that was shady AF and helping them get money for it.
See, that's what I just find so interesting about all of these stories in the book, on the podcast, is that you take these stories that people might not know at all, but then it's kind of like you're drawn to that to tell the story.
Right. And to be honest with you, your original question is, how does the voiceless come across? And is it something that they want to correct, something that would either people, the populace was misinformed? We had found one story on the Natchez Trail, and it was such a fascinating story because the voiceless coming through was a criminal who really wanted to be legitimized in life and in death. So he was like not giving up this persona of who he was when he was alive. And he's like, you know, I wasn't that bad of a criminal. How are we going to present this story? Because the man legit is a criminal, and we get that he has something to say, but like, we don't want to glorify like, oh, he wasn't that bad of a criminal. Right. So we had to be really thoughtful. And that was Sam, the Wolfman Mason. Mm-hmm. Do you want to talk about that, Jen?
I mean, I think you kind of summarized it well. He, in the early 1700s and 1800s, he also operated a criminal ring whereby he and his entire family were mostly robbing, but they did do some violent acts. What was interesting, like Jill said about him, was we didn't like him and we didn't believe him. And it's interesting when we're getting information from spirit, because the voice is not always reliable. And sometimes we have to sort through that too.
You might be led to something and maybe there's someone kind of trying to manipulate it.
Absolutely.
Interesting.
Yeah, that's true.
Mm-hmm. And I think that our biggest, in the book, not only do we redone our transcripts, but we added on like souvenirs and things like what to know if you go. And in the souvenirs portion, after every story, we talk about what we learned from the experience. And from Sam, the Wolfman Mason, that's exactly what we learned, that just because someone so clearly on the other side believes something to be true, that they want their story to be told, we have to digest that information with a grain of salt and think, A, who am I speaking to? How does the narrative come across to me? Is that in line with how I feel? Like, how does that, this information coming to me, the same way you would talking to someone if you first meet them, right? If you're buying a car and you're talking to the salesman, how are you feeling? Could you accept everything they're saying as truth? Are they guiding you to a conclusion? That was how we experienced Sam the Wolfman Mason. And I think we fairly came together with a narrative that not only exposed what he wanted the narrative to be, but also our feelings on it. And I hope that we did that artfully in that story for people listening and reading.
You know, one thing that I just thought of when you were talking about this, Sam the Wolfman, what was his last name?
Mason.
Mason, because that's a super creepy name. And just being open enough to where someone like him could get information to you, how do you shut that down? Like, you know, Sam, the Wolfman Mason, I don't want you around in my life, but I will go ahead and follow this and research it. So is there a way that you kind of protect yourself at the same time from that?
For all things in life, whether it be people that I'm afraid of, I'm the biggest scaredy cat. I have an anxiety problem. But for all things, whether it be spirit, people, life experiences, I always call on St. Michael. We grew up with multiple statues of St. Michael in our house. He's one of my biggest heavies on the other side, that I rely on him in every situation. So I feel comfortable that I'm protected. And if even anger from myself, like if I'm like disproportionately angry at something, I'm like, St. Michael, I just need to chill out with this. Let's like send me some cold water or something. So I feel very comfortable in that respect. Sometimes when we're in really charged areas that make us feel super scared, we picture leaving a cemetery or leaving a place, going through this threshold with like a shimmer of light and love that will dissolve any negativity from following us. But other than that, that's really what we do to kind of to cleanse it out. And we, to be honest, we didn't have a formal way of doing it until after we had an experience where a very evil spirit followed us. And then we're like, oh, we need to do this. We need to ask them to not follow.
Because especially with what some of this information you're uncovering, you know, these are some bad people and some, or maybe like the, what's the other one? The one in Savannah, Georgia. You know, you're kind of telling a woman's story who was a victim. I think it was her husband who did it. Bad guy. So, you know, you're kind of interacting with some really evil spirits. And so I just think that could be, you know, it's fascinating. But at the same time, I'm like, girls, protect yourselves.
No, that's fair. I think in Savannah, in that experience, who was really, we were getting channeled by the most was Eliza Gribble, I think her name was, Jen. Is that right?
Yes, that is absolutely right.
She was the one pulling us in, because even though the Savannah, the infamous axe murders of Savannah were highly publicized at the time, they didn't stop and ask themselves why these two bystanders were horribly slaughtered. And so really, that was the point of that story. So although, like, yes, these happened and this woman was killed by her husband, the husband killed two other people for seemingly no reason in a very violent manner. And I think that that was the reason for us telling the story. Like, don't forget, these other women were killed too, and this is probably the reason for it.
And you're able to bring that story to people, which gives her some peace. So that's right there in giving a voice to the voiceless.
Jen, that's your favorite story. Do you want to describe it a little bit better?
Yeah, that is my favorite story from our book, the one from Savannah, Georgia. In 1909, like Jill said, there were the infamous axe murders in Savannah. And they occurred at the house of Eliza Gribble. She was an elderly woman, and she lived with her daughter, Carrie. And Eliza and Carrie had just rented a room the day before the murders. They had just rented a room to a woman named Maggie Hunter. Now, Maggie Hunter had just left her husband, and she was involved in sort of a love triangle because she also had a lover. And so the following day, the day after she moved into the house, someone with an axe entered the home and killed not only Maggie, but also the elderly Eliza, the owner of the home, as well as her daughter, Carrie. And the murder was linked to Maggie's estranged husband. And the papers at the time, reading through these historical accounts, all just brush off the fact that Eliza and Carrie were murdered. And it was assumed by law enforcement and investigators that they just happened to be at the wrong place at the wrong time, that the murderer went in targeting Maggie. And because Eliza and Carrie were both in the house, they were also slaughtered. But Jill and I, through our research and our intuition, and through communicating with the spirit of Eliza, we found out that Eliza and Carrie had operated a home for women and children in need. And back in the early 1900s, that meant that if a woman was in an abusive relationship and needed to get out, they could go to Eliza's house. And so they were known in the community for offering this refuge to women. And we believe, and I'm getting goosebumps right now, we believe that Eliza was, and her daughter, Carrie, were both specifically targeted because they were, in the mind of the murderer, aiding and abetting his wife, allowing her, you know, giving her that freedom and allowing her to leave the abusive relationship that she was in. And I'm really proud. I'm really proud that we brought this up. Whereas after over 100 years, none of the investigators had really taken a close look at why these other two women were murdered.
And they were good people. You know, they're just helping people. I'm sure at the time, everything about them was kind of sidebar. It's the stories, this woman and her husband and her lover, because that's scandalous.
Yeah, absolutely.
And at that time, women had nowhere to go. You know, women didn't have the rights they have today. Right. I don't even know. Like, they wouldn't have even had the right to vote. So moving on from an abusive relationship, you know, the fact that these women were giving them a place to stay, that was very major, ahead of their time.
Yes.
I think another disappointing aspect of the story is that in parts of Savannah, not only is the story well known, but exploited for entertainment purposes. And so Eliza and her daughter, Carrie, are footnotes in their own murder. Yeah. And I think that that is, that to me was, is hard to think about, like, oh, the only the reason why people know about me is this horrible way that I died and not the way that I lived and the service that I was providing or why I even died, no one cared about.
Yes.
So I'm really happy to be a part of that story with Jen.
And what's interesting to me is, too, when you read about each one of these stories, there's a different approach to how you got there, like that when you're walking in Savannah and you're drawn to this. And then you're like, you get there and you're like, what the hell are we doing here? You know, nothing's open. Like, what are we supposed to do with this?
And we felt so unpsychic. We're like, what in the hell? Like, why are we in this location? This is so bad.
Because we were in a parking lot. We were literally standing in the middle of a parking lot and everything around us was closed.
And like, what could have happened here? And then you find out you didn't have any idea what had happened there.
No. The house was gone.
It's so funny to do the research. And then when, like, usually I take the lead on the research just because of our day jobs. And when I find like the hits are being validated, I will track Jennifer down and be like, guess what? And I'm getting so excited. I'm like, this is what happened. It's like so, so exciting to find the stories behind the hits. Because when we're on location, we usually have absolutely no idea. It's weeks later that we're putting it all together through our notes. And it's such a rush and it gets so exciting when things come together. And there have been times that like, I've tracked Jennifer down when she's getting her hair done or when she's at school. She's like, I'm in a meeting. I'm like, Jennifer, right now.
Well, and that's another thing about the book that I found very interesting. So you read the story and then you've got some of the pictures of these people. You've got copies of the newspaper articles at the time. And then you go way into, you know, you have footnotes in this book. Like, this is where we got the information. So it's not like you guys just are going through the talking to the locals and find out what they say about it. You do digging into these stories.
We take it very seriously.
Yeah, we do. And I think we provided enough resources. So if someone wanted to take one of our stories and do their own research, we would love that. You know, we provided pretty much all of the sources that we used, and there are multiple. We do a deep dive on our stories.
And then the other thing I loved was, so say you're on a road trip and here's, you know, you give some directions. Here's where to find this. Here's a good place to eat. Here's a place we had ice cream that we liked. And in Wichita, you like the Town East Mall, and the TJ Maxx apparently is better than a lot of others.
That's really good. We got a lot of good stuff from the TJ Maxx.
It's hit and miss. I'm just telling you. Sometimes I go there and I get a lot. And other times I'm like, dang, there was not one thing I spent my money on today. But that's what I love about it. It's like you could go look into this yourself and you could see what we're talking about. It's just very interesting. And since it is volume one, it makes me think, obviously, there's going to be more volumes of the Ghosts on the Road, Murder and Mysterious Deaths.
That is the plan. We don't know how many volumes are coming, but our publisher is interested in many more.
And these are the type of stories I love. And so I've already like been taking a deep dive into the book and the podcast because I love hearing history and then kind of taking a, you know, doing a deep dive into that. They're very, very interesting stories.
I really appreciate you saying how differently we come up with the stories or the way our psychic hits manifest, because I think that that's a part of it for the listeners and just like the everyday people who think, could I be psychic? Yeah, you can. And it doesn't always have to be one way. We could experience a song in our head that won't go away, or we can experience, like Jennifer had a really good hit. I love it that she kept hearing purple petunias for no reason. And then lo and behold, we drive through a little small main street where the whole street is decorated with purple petunias. So we're like, well, we're here. It's like those kind of things happen when you're looking for them and you're open to receiving those kind of hits, and anyone can do it.
Because you say that you believe we are all common mystics, but I just think a lot of people, they want the big signs and they're going right past the purple petunias.
Exactly.
So check out the podcast. It's really well done. And I was real excited to talk to you guys because I'm like, I feel like I could be friends with you guys. Like,
you know? I love to go to Wichita and drive around with you.
You come anytime you want, or I will meet you somewhere. You just let me know.
Thank you for having us. We were so excited and honored that you emailed us. You don't even know how happy we were.
I saw the book and the whole premise for it and listening to the podcast. I'm like, I've got to talk to these girls. So
we really appreciate it.
Carol, are you going to go with your sister out and try it?
Oh my God, yes. My sister is a total, like, I tell her that things just follow her wherever she goes. You know, she's drawn to it. I am, but I'm like Jennifer. So I tend to kind of shut it down because I'm like, I don't want anything following me home. I don't want this. I don't want this, rather than just go with it. And my sister just goes with it. So it's kind of similar to your dynamic.
Yeah.
I love it.
We're going to get in trouble. We're going to be conjuring some shit.
Yeah.
Well, I just appreciate this so much. It's been such a fun conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
And that wraps up our conversation about Ghosts on the Road, Murder and Mysterious Deaths, a new book from Jennifer James and Jill Stanley. You can find their book on Amazon and check out their podcast, Common Mystics, wherever you listen to podcasts. If you'd like access to all of our episodes, including the archive and advance episodes, everything commercial free, become a Gravekeeper. Sign up on Apple Podcasts. You can try it 3 days free, or go to patreon.com/thegravetalks and find everything there, also all ad free. I'm Carol Hughes, and for all of us at The Grave Talks, thanks for listening.